You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Blessed above all of creation, it was a rare and precious pearl. Conceived in faith and liberty, home of the brave, land of the free, it was the envy of the world. But this shining city on a hill has turned from the Creator's will and let evil take control. The reckless men who lead them want to strip away their freedom and to steal their very soul. Now it's smoke and mirrors, switch and bait, criticize, confiscate, and let the guilty walk away. In this once righteous, godly nation, in the halls of education, they forbid the child to pray. They say we need to spread the wealth. They pretend to guard the health of the feeble and the poor. While the hand they hold behind their back confuses and conceals the fact that the wolf is at the door. There's an unseen hand.
Well, thank you, people, for joining us today for Connecting the Dots. I'm out of the area right now in Arizona, and I have no email capability where I'm at, and I have no ability to get my computer up and running. So because I am in that situation, Thumper was kind enough to get me on the at least the telephone connection. We have a terrific subject today that we're going to be talking about, and that is private property, property rights, the war on the West. And many of us live out here in the West. We know exactly what that means. There is a very, very open and a very pointed attack on property rights in the West. And that is because of a program called UN Agenda 21 2030 that is trying to turn over 50% of the United States back into what they term as pre-Columbian wilderness area. That means before Columbus landed on the American continents and the islands, before white man existed here is what they're trying to turn this country back into. And it translates into a war against farmers, ranchers, property owners all over the Western United States. And why do I say the Western United States? Because for the most part, it's the least developed part of the country. And they figure, well, what the heck, we can lose a few million people. There are farmers and ranchers and people who live on the land. And the fact is, they aren't thinking very far, because those same farmers and ranchers produce an awful lot of the food that America depends on. And
hey, Dan?
When they shut down, yes, sir.
We have Ammon in the room with us.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful. Ammon, thank you for joining us. I am very much looking forward to this conversation. I was just telling our listeners that so much of this is really predicated on a program called UN Agenda 21-2030 that identifies most of the Western United States as being a candidate for pre-Columbian wilderness. They want to turn it back into the way it was before a white man set foot on the continent. And the reality is that if they try to do that, they're going to destroy a huge segment of our food production and a very important number one consideration of our country, and that is our constitutional guarantees of private property. So with that, Ammon, you and your family have experienced firsthand the heavy hand of government and how the federal government, and sometimes in cooperation with a very complacent and a very cooperative state government, are learning how to destroy individual rights in this country in an unprecedented way. And your family certainly felt the pressure of that. And we've got a 2-hour program here where I want Ammon to really talk about how all these things happened to their family, and I'll throw in a few words here and there to kind of talk about some things that may not otherwise get talked about. But Ammon, this program is real for you. Yes, sir.
Okay. Excuse me. Ammon, I think he's having a little issue there. He wasn't able to he didn't have his microphone showing there, and he just blinked out of the room. He's probably going to try to reconnect again. So I'm not sure if he was able to hear what you were saying there or not. So, next time he pops his head in there, I'll see what I can do to get his attention and help him through any issues he has.
Okay. All right. Very good. Well, in any case, this is a subject that probably is at the very center of all the things that are happening in this country that people can't explain, how and why we are losing our rights at such an incredible pace, and how so many of the things that we took for granted growing up as kids in this country as being something that was uniquely but solidly American, and that is the rights to property, the rights to freedom, free choice, the right to keep and bear arms, the right to think and say whatever, as long as it didn't hurt someone else directly, the freedom to make all kinds of personal choices that we haven't we are seeing disappear at an incredible rate. And right now, what's going on in this country, I think, if we had looked back 30, 40 years ago, most people, if you had said the things that are going on today were going to happen, I think most people, including myself, would have said, you're nuts. That'll never happen in the United States of America. That will not happen in our constitutional republic. Well, we've been electing communists, we've been electing progressive socialists, we've been electing people into office who are totally antithetical to the United States of America as a constitutional republic. They are traitors to our Constitution and to their oath of office. There's no question about that. But that has not stopped them from trying to, quote unquote, fundamentally transform the United States of America and turn it from a constitutional republic into a Marxist democracy. And that certainly was happening at light speed before President Trump came on board. And, Trump, with all his flaws, I believe that man really understands what's happening, and he is 100% dedicated to restoring the country to the constitutional Republican form of government that it was intended to be. So with that, we do have an opportunity today to talk to someone who probably more than just about anybody in our country stands out as a family who not only talk the talk, but they walk the walk. And it cost them dearly. It cost them several years of freedom. It cost them a tremendous amount of a personal cost and loss in terms of It impacted their livelihoods. It impacted everything about their families.
Okay. We have Ammon in the room now, and it looks like Ammon, can you give us a little voice check there, please?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
5x5, sir. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Ammon, I was just talking about your family. You and your family probably stand out more than any other individuals in recent memory as people who not only faced the federal government, but you walk the walk as well as talking the talk about defending your liberty, because you wouldn't let the system and the government push you around in a way that you knew was unconstitutional. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for the fact that you folks would take the heat that was necessary to stand up and be noticed in a way, not because you wanted to be noticed, but because you were trying to defend liberty for the rest of the country. You were trying to make America aware that we are no longer a constitutional republic the way the founders envisioned, but we have become a Marxist socialist democracy, and it is destroying our way of life in a way that I don't think people, you know, could possibly understand until we lose it. So with that, welcome to the show, and thank you for being here. And we're going to be talking about the standoff at Bunkerville. We're also going to be talking about the standoff there, right? I guess a better term is occupation at Malheur, and some of the things that have happened in your life as a result of trying to do the right thing. And I've never met your dad. I met you, but I've never met your dad. But I know he is a man of incredible integrity. I read the book that was written about him, and Mike, I'm trying to think of his last name, but anyway, an excellent book, and all I can say is that I really appreciate what you folks have done.
Well, thank you. I have to say that my father is the one that has been the good example here. We're, of course, carrying it on, and this is a battle that he's had to fight, you know, nearly his entire life. When my grandfather, he kind of got to the point where he was ready to move to town, I guess. And he told my dad, this ranch is yours if you want it. And, my grandpa made my dad a deal where he purchased it for an amount that he could afford, and he paid on it until my grandmother passed away. That was their deal. Well, my grandfather and grandmother, but my grandmother outlived my grandfather about 21 years. So anyway, my dad felt that it was something that he had to continue. He felt that it was needed to continue the ranch and his heritage that was, you know, passed on to him. And so, and he saw this, it's not just about cows, as you mentioned, it's about much more than that. And my father recognized that and knew that he had to stand, and not only for himself or for his ranch, but for everybody in this country. And in fact, if it was just for my dad, I know that he wouldn't have stood. He wouldn't have done it just for himself, I guess what I'm saying. He did it because it was, there's something going on much greater than just protecting cows on the desert. So,
right. Well, I think we all kind of feel that way, and that's the reason that there are, you know, people in the Patriot movement that have sort of, I guess you'd call us willing but not necessarily wanting to be involved, but yet we know that we can't do otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess that's what, you know, love for your fellow man brings. It brings the realization of what's going on. If you'll look into it, you know, and seeing that there's a terrible direction, the trajectory of America is in a terrible position. And, you know, it's actually, I think all in all, still a pretty great life that we have. We live here. And so we're caught in this, you know, this almost contradictory time where things outside look pretty good. You know, we're still doing all right for the most part. But yet, you don't have to look very far, and you can see that one is freedom has declined tremendously over the past 100 years in this country. But also that it's going to come to a head. It has to come to a head. There is no other way for it to, if we continue the direction we're going, it will come to a head. And I think we saw that at the Bundy Ranch, because what was happening, you know, for the last 30 years is that they had attacked the rural ranchers. They had attacked the loggers, the miners, basically anybody who had rights to the land. And we could talk about why they did that at some time, you know, in this show. But basically, anybody who had any rights or claim to the land and the natural resources, they began to attack. Systematic, and they one by one would take them out. They would never do it like in a mass amount. They would always do it one by one. And as soon as it got noticed in a certain area, then they would leave that area and they'd go somewhere else into another, you know, state or another part of the country. And then
Dan?
Yeah, I'm something's going on here with the phone, but I'm here.
Yeah, okay. Looks like Ammon his stream might have locked up a little bit. We'll give him a few moments here to see if it unlocks.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, I know it went dead, and I thought maybe it was my phone that was a problem. So, okay.
Your phone was feeding quite a bit of noise through the through the feed there for some reason.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that was the problem, I guess, because it went completely dead for a while. So, okay. All right. Well, I might mention the fact I didn't hear Ammon talk about it, but his family had been in that Bunkerville area and been on that location since the 1850s. And so they have quite a history of farming and ranching in the area. And it wasn't like they were newcomers to the area. They had been there for a very long time, and his family had. And so it was not something that, when the government came in and said that, they were trespassing, they were actually there about 50 or 60 years before the federal government created the BLM, or the land agencies, Department of the Interior. So they had been on that land for, you know, several generations before the federal government laid any claim to that land, other than the fact that it was part of the territory of the United States of America. And they had homesteaded there. They had gone through the struggles of being ranching in a very, very difficult environment. And people who did that, they sacrificed a great deal to be there. So all I can say is that they had the right to be there because they had been there for generations and it worked. And, you know, improved the water to the area. They had drilled wells. They had done a lot of the work that was necessary to make that a productive ranch land. So that's an important thing for our listeners to realize. You know, as we're talking about the standoff at Bunkerville, because basically from the government's perspective, the only thing you'll hear them talk about is how Cliven Bundy had failed to pay the grazing permit fees to the BLM.
Okay, Dan, Ammon's back with us here.
Okay, good. Ammon, I was just mentioning that your family had been in that area there for, 150 years or better?
No, you're muted, Ammon. All right, you're good now.
Hear me now?
You're five. Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, great.
So I apologize. I really don't know what happened there. It just completely shut off. But
if we run into that problem, you can shut down the video and just go audio only if it's like a bandwidth issue or something like that. But keep with the video. The folks like to see your face. So, okay. And if I might remind you. You know, what you're seeing here, Dan can't see what's happening on the screen because he's coming in from his phone. So I'm kind of playing middleman here.
No problem.
Okay.
So, yeah, Dan, around 145 years to date that my family mm-hmm. been there. We came into the Southern Nevada area in 1877. And just kind of give you a little perspective there and the listeners a little perspective. This was before there was even one tent in Las Vegas. There was no such thing as Las Vegas. My family went into that area. They began to carve a very hard, difficult life out of the desert. And they immediately found, springs up on the mountain. They're very small springs, but they were artesian springs. They developed those springs and built water troughs to capture the water so that they could run cattle on the mountain. And through the generations, they have piped those, my family and other ranchers in the area have piped those waters down into the lower foothills all over that desert. And it basically is the lifeblood of our ranch. And my father has mm-hmm. probably developed that water in his time more than, well, for sure, without doubt, more than any other rancher, that's ever ranched in that area. He's extended those waters for, miles and miles and miles. So that's kind of the history of our, it's, like I said, 145 years. And in reality, there's not a whole lot of change of what we're doing other than, we have pickups and four-wheelers where we'll go check the, the waters and the traps and stuff. But we still do a tremendous amount of work, on horseback. We still wrap our cattle. And there's not a whole lot has changed as far as operational-wise because of the condition of the ranch. It's arid. It takes about 100 acres to produce enough feed for one cow for a year mm-hmm. to survive. So, and my dad runs approximately about 600 head of cattle right now. So, technical issue, I was talking about how, the Bureau of Land Management, these U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service, U.S. Forest Service, how they were, systematically removing people that had rights to the land. And they were doing this in many different, you know, methods. They're still doing it. But what they would do is, for, you know, some, usually they use the environment, the environmental issues, you know, usually driven by environmental. They would use some excuse, like in our case, the desert tortoise. It could be the spotted owl. It could have been the, like right now, they're using the sage grouse. And they use this as a way to tighten up the restrictions, to justify tighten up the restrictions, and make it so that it's really impractical for the land users to be able to make a living off of it. And so they literally just have to, you know, hang up their business, you know, hang up their ranches, whatever else it is they're doing, and go move to town so they could get a job and make a living for their family, because they live literally through regulations create a situation where they're starving them to death. And the you know, design behind it is that anybody who has claims to the land, it's been passed down to them, or any rights, they have to be removed so that there is nobody who will fight for it. You know, and then they're replaced with just a lease, someone who will lease it from them. Or they're not replaced at all. They're just completely, you know, they're, you know, the no use policy is implemented in a lot of areas. And so now here comes the federal government claiming that they own the natural resources after they have removed thousands and thousands and thousands of, you know, land users, land, not just users, but those who had rights to it. And they can come along on top and say, well, it's ours now, and no one will fight or say the otherwise. They're already gone. They're out of the picture. And that's what we've seen transpire in the last couple generations. Until now, these new generations, I mean, they don't even know that at one time there was actually titled rights, or registered with the states, where they had vested property. They don't know that they're, you know, that in their family that these rights were there. And they believe that well, it's public land, and you know that, yeah, one time there was a ranch there that their dad or grandfather or great grandfather had, but for some reason now it's gone, and you know, if we're lucky, we can go camping, and that's literally what has happened. So it's been strategic, it's been generational, and their own maps that identify that, I think they identify that there's $170 trillion worth of subsurface minerals in the West. I don't even know how you could figure such a thing, but that's a lot, to be able to claim that wealth. And not only that, what about the waters? What is the waters worth? And let me explain that a little bit, because you may or may not know, that the waters are supposed to be under the jurisdiction of the state. I mean,
right?
You know, in the West, I don't know how it is in the East, but it's, you know, it's by law, the state has a water engineer and a water resource department, and they control and manage and have jurisdiction over water rights. And you can register, you can claim waters. You begin to use it, prove up on it, and you could claim it, and it's titled and registered in the state. And what we have here is where the federal government's coming in and saying to, let's say, a rancher, and they're saying, and the rancher owns water. And in Nevada, the waters and the grazing rights were listed together in the same the same deed. And so the federal government would come along and say, look, we're not going to authorize you use this land around the water. And so they drive the rancher off, and so the rancher can't use the water. Well, by law, after some states it's just 5 years, others it's seven. But if you don't use the water within that period of time, within 5 years or 7 years, and prove up on it, then someone else can actually claim those water rights. And so we look into Nevada, and we see where people were driven off these waters are because the federal government says they own the land. And we'll talk about whether they own it or not here in a bit. And then 5 to 7 years later, the federal government, either through the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Department of Interior, or one of the other agencies, they actually file on the water and deed it to themselves in the state registry. Right. And they've done this almost six, well, they, with just the four entities that I've did the research on, which was the Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the encompassing U.S. Department of Interior, they've done it over almost 6,000 times in Nevada alone. And I haven't done any research in the other states. So we're talking about, a mass amount of water rights that are now under the control of the federal government because they drove these individuals off the land and then filed in the state on top of them. Well, that is absolutely unconstitutional. We have laws that are in the Constitution that make it so that the federal government cannot compete against the people when it comes to the land and the resources. And so, and that was for our protection. It was to protect us from, exactly what I'm describing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, to protect us from the crown, because in England, the royalty, the crown, owned the land, and the people were entitled to use it only at the crown's discretion, and that's exactly what they were trying to make sure didn't happen in our country.
Yeah, imagine the power that you could have, which we don't have to imagine, we see it right now, but where you can extract taxes, or a tribute, whatever you want to call it, right? You can extract that out of the people, and then with that, you can go, and then coupled with that, you have basically a force, and with the funds and the force, you can go and drive the people off the land, or you can just purchase it from them, through basically put them in duress and then purchase it from them. And then you buy it all up and now the people, they don't have use of it. So, and you could just keep, and then because of that, you get more wealth and you continue to extract more out of the people. You drive them to the cities. You continue to extract more out of them. And with that, you go and compete with them more and more, but not on a fair basis. You're actually competing with them being funded by their own taxes and then taking away their rights, the land and the resources. And the founders, they wanted to make sure that didn't happen.
Right.
They wanted to make sure that the government, in which was charged to protect their rights, did not become a competitor to them. And so they set these laws up. Article 1817, which made it illegal for the federal government to own and control property inside the state unless they followed a very specific limited process. And that process mm-hmm. was if they needed property, let's say for an enumerated purpose, right? And mm-hmm. enumerated purpose is basically to fulfill the authorized purposes or, you know, basic authorized purposes in the Constitution.
Ports and docks and post offices and necessary government functions, not all these things that they're doing now.
Yeah, so you have in Article 1, you have a list of enumerated authorities that are given the federal government. Well, Article 1817 was giving them authority to get property from the states to fulfill those purposes, but nothing else. But they had to go to the state representatives. They had to go to the state legislatures. According to the Constitution, they have to go to the state legislatures. They have to purchase it. So the state legislatures have to vote on it, and they have to authorize the federal government to using that land or that property. And then the federal government has to purchase it from the rightful owner, whoever it is. And then they can only use it for the enumerated purposes, or as the Constitution says, for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Well, if that was followed, we would never have had the problems that we have had in the West. We would never have had the Bundy standoff. My family would never have had to have gone through these issues. And the hundreds of thousands of ranchers and loggers, miners, and other land users would have never had to go through the issues they've had to, driven into the cities. And actually, the West would look completely different than it is. We would have, communities that were much smaller. And what we have in the West, like Nevada, basically, you have Las Vegas and Reno and a few little trickling towns running off basically the casino attraction, so like on the borders and stuff. And
it looks like he locked up a little bit there.
Yeah, well, certainly. Back.
Ammon, you there?
Yep, I'm here. Bordered up ghost towns. That's what they are. And so... Yeah. And why is that? That's simply because Article 1817 has not been followed. The federal government has come in and basically said, this land belongs to us. The natural resources belong to us. They drove anybody off the land that had claim and rights to it. And now they are saying that any benefit, any profit, and any use has to be is theirs, and that you can rent it if you want, if they allow you to, but no one in the West owns it but them, and that's just the facts.
Yeah, no, that is the fact, and anyone that stands up against them becomes a target because they want to make sure that no one stands up against them. Now, isn't it true that your dad was the last rancher in that area out of, 67 or 69
other
ranchers? 53, okay. That had been forced off the land in that immediate area and following the process that you're talking about. They say, well, you don't have the right, you may own the water, to water your cattle, but you don't have the right to graze your cattle there. Now, even though they've been there for a very long time, and incidentally, anyone that knows, that grew up on a ranch, knows anything about ranching, understands that the desert or any other ground is much better after it's grazed. If you use a managed grazing plan, it actually improves the ground immensely. And your family, the areas where they had had grazing and they had had water developed for stock water and so forth, those areas were actually much more productive after they had done all that work and all those improvements than they ever were before.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, a side effect, you know, with man, with man using the land, you know, taking care of it. The benefit, I mean, you know, you want just the benefit of the wildlife because of all these waters. I mean, you go around each water trough and you'll see quail and pheasant and you'll see, you know, all kinds of wildlife, birds, coyotes, rabbits, and, you know, that would otherwise not be there. They would actually, you know, they wouldn't be able to be there. They would have to go too far to get water. And because of that, they, you know, and so the hunters, they enjoy it, you know, the hikers, campers, and even the bird watchers, they go and enjoy it, right? And they don't even realize that it's Clive and Bundy that has made that happen. And he's done it at his own expense, and he's maintained it, and he keeps those waters full all year round. And it's a lot of work to do that. You know, each water has its own challenge. You know, kind of giving you an example, those water pipes, they get this, like, it's not alkali, but it's like this lime almost flake. It'll clog up the waters. So my dad has developed where he has, he's one of those great big buoys that, you know, you see in the oceans that are chained to the cables. He's got one of those. He fills it up with air. It's about, you know, 120, 130 pounds of ash, but it's a lot of volume. And he goes up and he blows out those water lines, and he has to do it every so often, you know, otherwise they'll get restricted. And that's the type of stuff that he's constantly doing. And he has to do it all over, you know, literally hundreds of miles of rough desert land. The lower ranch is 80 miles from the house. And so, kind of gives you an idea of, I mean, and he doesn't, there's no government funding or program that he uses or would ever use. He does this, you know, because that's what he needs to do to keep his ranch running. And he, I mean, you know, another thing that I always like to say, you know, my dad was building these tanks and water troughs, you know, way before I was even born. I'm 44 years old. Well, he has water troughs that he probably built 50 years ago, and they're steel tanks that he cut in big steel tanks he cut in half, and he put a ramp on them. So there's a ramp coming out the water. 50 years ago, he did this. Well, why would he do that? You have any idea? Any idea, Dan?
Oh, I have every idea. Yeah, anything that falls in can get back out.
Yeah, so like of a little quail that is trying to get a drink, fell in there, he could get out, or a little rabbit or anything, or so that they can get in and out to get a water, get a drink. Mm-hmm. Now, that was done on my dad on his own accord. You know, it wasn't a mandate. It wasn't anything that he did that because my dad is a true environmentalist. And he has blessed and benefited that land, and he has kept it free and open for his entire life. But because he will not give up his claim and his right and his heritage to the land, they came after him. And, you know, it was a 30-plus year battle, but they came after him, you know, legally. And if you want, we could kind of go down that path, and I could share with you some more details of those people.
Yeah, I do want to go down that path. And Ammon, I have to ask a question. Is Ryan, some of your other siblings, are they going to keep the ranch going after your dad's gone? Because it would be a crying shame to have gone through the travails that he has and then the family abandon the place. And I think of Hammonds. I think of you know, the fact that, well, we'll get into that too, but, you know, really, I had a Hank Vogler on my radio show. We were talking, and it was the fact that they had actually filed a claim on water that was coming off the public land that he felt was at the very basis of why they went after the Hammond. So, you know, you're talking about water. Water is the new gold of the West. It's just that simple. And they want that water, and if somebody's making beneficial use of it, they really can't claim it until they can get them off the water.
Well, see, the water is just the last thing, though, because, and you're absolutely right, but use the water as the example, because what are they doing? They're going after anybody who has water rights on the land, because that's the last rights that are on it. But it wasn't very many few years ago, just a couple decades ago, that there was all kinds of rights, not just water rights. There was grazing rights, mineral rights, logging rights. You know, they were all these rights, and they were vested property rights deeded with the states. And over just a few decades, they have literally destroyed these rights and turned them, actually destroyed most of them. And the ones that they didn't destroy, they turned into a privilege. And now they're going after the waters. And the ranchers were, you know, saying, hey, look, this is going to affect you. Well, now it is. I mean, the waters. Mm-hmm. Waters are the last. So the very thing that you see and are explaining with the waters, Dan, is exactly what happened in the last several decades with all the other rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. But it is one that has a tremendous amount of additional value because of places like Las Vegas and Los Angeles. But yeah, I'm not going to. I'll let you continue your thought. But the bottom line is your family, all the work your dad put into all that surrounding land, so-called public land, in water features and stuff, were a huge benefit to the natural environment there. You know, the environmentalist can't say that he hurt the land. He actually made it that much more productive.
Absolutely. I mean, they want to, you know, say something. There's no way they could, you know, practically say that in any way my dad has not been, you know, the best environmentalist of that land. Mm-hmm. But they don't care because it's not about environmentalism. Yeah, they use the environmentalists as a tool to justify action, to get publicity, you know, to be activists. They use them, but it's not about that. It's about control. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about driving people off the land and into the cities, and it's about them getting, you know, their hands on the power that the natural resources provide. And just like you said, water is the most valuable resource in that area, probably in any area, because water is a limited resource. I mean, there's only so much water in the atmosphere. And at times it'll change, you know, it'll change where we've got more ice in Antarctica, and then it'll time where it'll melt, or maybe we got more water on the mountains. There'll be, you know, snow, and it'll change. So it becomes, in certain areas, more valuable than in other areas. And of course, in the desert, it is a valuable resource, and they know that. And so they're trying to get control of it. But it's no different than them trying to control the land, trying to control the other natural resources. It's just that water was kind of the last, because it was such the most valuable, and so many people relied on it and claimed it, and it was the best resource that was actually documented, meaning the states actually created deeds that were very clear, and so it was the hardest for them to get a hold of. But now, through these deceptions and through this guise of public land, they've been able to get control of most of the water, and just completely disrespecting the state's water laws and the individual rights to water that had already been established. But again, no different from the property rights and the resource rights, grazing rights, mining rights, logging rights, mineral rights, no different from any of those. Same tactics, mm-hmm. same methods. They've just had to do it strategically to make sure that there wouldn't be an uprise. And they almost got it done. American people are sitting there going, what happened? Well, because you fell asleep and you didn't realize generationally what you lost. So anyway.
One of the problems that we have out here in the West, and incidentally, I come from farming and ranching family, and so I understand exactly how important all these things are: property rights, how important water, how important the ability to manage your land. Because truthfully, we are far and away the best conservationists. We are the best at producing cost-effective and sensible management of the land. And the people that are, I guess, the useful idiots of the left in the environmental community, 90% of them come from a non-farm, non-ranch, natural resource background, and so they listen to this nonsense that is being promoted by programs like UN Agenda 21, and they actually believe this this nonsense is being truthful.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, give you a real example of that is. Kind of what started the whole legal proceedings with the Bundy Ranch. They had pretty much taken out, you know, I would say there was probably about 15 ranchers left in the area. So they had taken out, you know, all of the 53, but about 15, maybe less than that, 12 or so. And they did what they came to those ranchers and said, hey, we're going to close the area off for ranching. And the ranchers were, wait a minute, you know, this was already after, you know, regulation after regulation. And, you know, anybody who tried to comply exactly to it, they just couldn't stay in business. So they went out of business. And now you get a stronghold or the remaining of about 12. And they said, well, we're going to close off the ranching completely. In fact, in the BLM Southern Nevada District office, it's on the wall, it said, no moo by 92, cattle free by 93. And so their design was to completely eliminate the ranchers and to drive the people, you know, off the land and into the cities. And, the way that they did this is they said that they were going to make, so what happened was Las Vegas was expanding and the Bureau of Land Management owned the land, well, controlled, because, I mean, we need to get into the legality of this, because the federal government doesn't own this land at all. They've just taken and claimed it and pushed everybody else off by force. So anyhow, but the Bureau of Land Management now claims the land around and landlocks Las Vegas. Well, Las Vegas is wanting more, you know, they're needing and wanting to expand. They already have, you know, all these subdivisions where you could jump from rooftop to rooftop for literally a mile. And now, you know, so they're already packed everybody in this landlocked area. And yet there's, you know, millions and millions of acres outside of Las Vegas. It's just not being used. And so now they get Las Vegas saying, hey, we want some more land. Well, who's right there ready to receive the money getting paid for that? Well, the Bureau of Land Management first, and then land developers like Rory Reed, which is Harry Reid's son. And Harry Reid, you know, he's over the Committee for Natural Resources in Congress, who's claiming, you know, control over the, you know, Bureau of Land Management and over the natural resources. And so you basically got the city of Las Vegas or the people of Las Vegas wanting to expand, which they never should be in that type of situation in the first place. They're wanting to expand. So they go to the Bureau of Land Management, and they purchase land under the authorization of the Congressional Natural Resource Committee, headed by Harry Reid. And the primary purchaser of the land is Rory Reid, his son. And they get it for a lot cheaper. But remember, the Bureau of Land Management makes a lot of money selling this land, and it's not their land.
If I may. That was exactly one of our YouTube chatters was asking specifically about Harry Reid and his involvement in some of this. And I think that a lot of our folks in the audience would be interested in, you know, a little deeper dive into, you know, Harry Reid's you've done a great job so far, but yeah.
Well, I can go further. So so you see that, you know, I guess what a good person would say the conflict of interest is, but remember the whole problem in the first place was that the federal government, Bureau of Land Management, was claiming that this land was theirs in the first place. They don't have title to it. They still to this day don't have title to it, but now they're selling this land to developers for Las Vegas development under the authorization of Harry Reid and the Congressional Resource Committee. And the Bureau of Land Management is taking this money in from the developers, but they're selling it for a lot less than development land should be sold. And who's purchasing it? Rory Reid, Harry Reid's son. And he's turning around and developing that land and making millions and millions and millions of dollars because he's taking land that he didn't have to pay a lot for. And he's developing it and selling it for a lot of money. Well, also what Harry Reid was also doing, and this came a little bit later, but this is kind of, I need to tie it in because it'll kind of all come together and they tied it in now. Harry Reid was making deals with the Chinese corporations for large solar farms, huge solar farms. Well, and he was doing it on this land that didn't belong to the federal government, that at one time belonged to ranchers and miners and loggers. And the local people in Clark County, but they already cleaned title. They already cleared all those people off. And now he's selling it, or at least selling the rights to these huge solar farms to a Chinese corporations. And this is not conspiracy. This is absolute fact. Yeah, there's no, I mean, the contracts are there. The agreements are in place, all of that. Okay, so now the environmentalists, they get involved, right? And they're saying, oh, because Las Vegas is expanding and because no wildlife can live in a solar farm because of the temperature in which it creates, we have to have a place for the wildlife to go, and in particular, the desert tortoise. Well, rather than just taking them out in the desert, right? Which they would probably, most of them just move out there anyway. There's plenty of area. Mm-hmm. The environmentalists get involved, right? And they start making a deal, which, you know, it's hard to tell whether the Bureau of Land Management and these federal agencies are environmental groups or whether they're the federal government. So it's hard to tell where they end and the environmental special interest groups begin.
They sleep together in the same bed. It's amazing because so many of the NGOs end up being administrative members of certain agencies, and they just kind of slide back and forth, don't they?
Yeah, well, they're the same. I mean, they've came from the same schooling. They've came from the same, you know, theology, the same ideology. They're the exact, you know, basically you can't tell one for the other. And you know, you'll even see them going back and forth. You know, someone will retire from the Bureau of Land Management. Next thing you know, they're the president of this, you know, NGO, I think a lot of people call it, or special interest group, environmentalist group. So it's, you know, but anyway, so they get involved and they see an opportunity to make a tremendous amount of money off of this situation. Okay. Besides the land sales. And so what they do is, so they say that we need a mitigation area for the wildlife, for the desert tortoise. We need a desert tortoise. They put them on the endangered species list, right? The desert tortoise. And they say, we need a mitigation area for this. And so they go find a mitigation area. Well, guess what the mitigation area was? Guess where it was at?
Your ranch.
And the other ranches. And so they say, then they come up with a bunch of garbage science, which is absolutely just garbage and has been proved garbage over and over, and say that the desert tortoise and the cattle can't live together, which is absolutely false. In fact, it's just opposite. They have a history. This is independent studies have shown over and over again that where there's more cattle, there's more desert tortoise. And that the primary source for when there's cattle on the land for the desert tortoise is the manure. And also that the cattle cultivate the land and keep it from the desertification or what we call desert asphalt, where it gets that crust, and allows the seeds that blow off the other, you know, plants and allows them to grow. So it causes that vegetation for the desert tortoise.
Exactly.
There's no proof. What's that?
Well, I was going to say, Stephen Rich has done a number of studies on that. And the fact is the hoof prints are a terrific way. It creates a divot in the ground so that the rain can collect there, and it gives it an opportunity for the grass to recede in those areas without traffic, without the hoof. Hoof prints of the cattle on the ground, the grass doesn't grow. Eventually it'll die off and there won't be any grass there at all.
Yeah, what happens in the desert, you're exactly right. And the split hoof is the best, which is the cow has a split hoof. They actually cultivate it and actually create where it where it actually cultivates the ground, and then it causes dividends in it and gets the rain in there, and it's a perfect environment for plants to grow. It actually, they can shove the seed down in the ground, cultivate it around it, and create a water pot. So you're exactly right. And what the desert does, and we see this all over the West where there's no cattle, it'll actually, what the environmentalists call desertification. And they've seen a huge amount of desertification increase over the past, 60 years over the world, to the point where they say that around 94% of the world is desertifying, or whatever they call it. Well, where you see the decrease of animal cattle count, you see the increase of desertification. There's no secret there, and they're starting to see it, but they won't. They're hesitant to acknowledge that that's, the cause. God's method of cultivating the ground was running cattle on it, or some type of cattle, a split-hoofed animal. And that's basically, and also they fertilize it through their dung and their urine. I mean, all of that is part of basically the beautiful cycle of nature on the land. And so, and that's been proven over. It's not even, to me, it's not, I don't even argue about that, because there is no room for argument, because there's no room for doubt.
And so
kind of going back to this, plot, they say that the ranch now is the mitigation area for the desert tortoise. And so they just tell the ranchers, this is just the way it is. You have to leave. And of course, the ranchers that are remaining, which I think there's only about 12 of them actually, they debate, go back and forth, and ultimately they say no. Well, so then they get the county involved, because remember, the county's vested because they're trying to expand Las Vegas. They get Clark County involved, and the Bureau of Land Management environmentalists basically come up with a plan And they offer all the ranchers to buy all the ranches. I won't tell you how much right now, but so tell me this. How could they buy the ranches if the ranchers don't have any rights? Okay, mm-hmm. So they did, but they only offered, I think it was $75,000 a piece is all. And 10 out of the 12 basically said, well, it's better than nothing. They're going to take it anyway. And they eliminated all but two, which was Keith Ney, a neighboring ranch just to the south of us, and Clive and Bundy. Mm-hmm. And then eventually what happened is, you know, Keith Ney fought with my dad, courts, exhausted funds, everything they could do to try to make their stand. And Keith Ney passed away of a heart attack. And it left my dad the only one out of 53 ranchers. And I will say this, the only one in the United States of America today that is ranching on his original rights. There was only one other ranch. All the rest of them had been taken, destroyed. There was only one other rancher that began, that nullified his contracts and began to ranch on his original rights. And can you imagine, can you guess who that was?
Well, I would say probably Dwight Hammond.
Nope. Lavoie Finicum.
Oh. Interesting. I guess I had heard that. I had read that, but I'd kind of forgotten about that. You're right.
He was the only other one besides my father that had gone through the process and began ranching on his original rights, as a property mm-hmm. owner should. And they killed him. And we could go into that into a lot more detail. But they killed him, they incarcerated my father, and they planned on keeping my father in prison his entire life, including his sons, because they were going to destroy this generational gap. They had, our minimum sentence was 106 years. Now, I don't know you, wow. I'm 44 years old, I ain't going to outlive that. None of my brothers are going to outlive that. So that means that they were going to take my dad out, take the next generation out, and so there would be no way that the third generation could claim any rights on the land. And then the other man who claimed rights, they just killed him. Mm-hmm. And so the reality of the situation, you know, is pretty grim. But I do want to continue to flush out this Harry Reid thing, because so my dad says no. Keith Ney says no. Keith Ney passes away. It leaves my dad the last man standing. This mitigation agreement that they made it with the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and the Clark County, Nevada. That they made that, and what they began to do, and it was all orchestrated by Harry Reid. And what they began to do was they also passed basically a county ordinance for that any person in Las Vegas that got a building permit had to pay us a percentage of that contract that they received through the permit, or not received, but that basically effectuated the, you know, through the permit. They had to pay a percent of that for mitigation fees. Now imagine, I mean, you're talking about $1 billion buildings in Las Vegas, right? I mean, the permit process, and ultimately over 20 years, the environmentalists, you know, including and primarily these federal agencies, collected estimated amount of $2 billion. Now, we know for sure it was hundreds of millions of dollars, but through basically a research of building permits using the percentage, it's estimated that it was close to $2 billion. That's a lot of money. Well, today, no one knows where that money went. Not even the county commissioners. They've even said it. We do not know where that money was. No one knows where that money went. It was extracted from the local people, from the local economy, and it was, and it went to the environmentalists in some way for this mitigation fee, and no one knows where it went. Now, the only thing that they can account for was, you know, literally a drop in the bucket when you're talking about that amount, but it was, you know, several million dollars, though. They built a facility, and it was supposed to be a facility where they took the desert tortoise to like acclimate him to the new mitigation area. So they'd bring the desert tortoise in, and, you know, it was a U.S. Fish and Wildlife that were doing it, and they would, you know, inspect him, and the doctors would look him over, and they would do things to him, and then they would, the idea was that they would, you know, get him ready, and they were collecting, you know, this millions of dollars, which is really a drop in the bucket for this entire mitigation fee, but they were still, you know, probably, who knows, you know, 20 to 50 people were making a good living doing this. And, but the results were, after 20 years, this: how many desert tortoise from the expansion of Las Vegas and from the solar, the contracted solar farms, how many of them went to this facility, then back on the mitigation areas, which were supposed to be my father's ranch? And in 20 years, the answer is zero. Not one desert tortoise went through this process, and they put them on the ranch. What happened was, is the desert tortoise got a disease inside these facilities, and they end up euthanizing them all of them.
Wow.
Thousands and thousands of desert tortoise. The only other exception is the ones that that they would they actually, I don't think they sold them, but they would can't think of the right name. Basically, make pets out of them, and people could come and get them for pets.
Oh, sure, an adoption.
Yeah, adoption program. Yeah, thank you. I should have. Besides that, and there was quite a few of them that went for adoption and then became the house pets, right? But they collected all of millions and millions of dollars, and estimated up to $2 billion. They created this facility, brought in desert tortoise. They destroyed 52 ranchers in the Southern Nevada area, and not one desert tortoise was saved. In fact, they euthanized thousands. And I don't know how many, but it's estimated around 20,000.
Hammond?
Yes.
If I may, somebody in the our live chat out there is bringing up the executive order that was signed by President Trump here not too long ago concerning the waters of the United States. Are you aware of that, or and how it might affect you, or?
Just a little bit. Because I'll tell you what, the president of the United States has no jurisdiction over the waters.
Mm-hmm.
Even the water flow, waterways, I haven't read it, so I don't know. I know that President Trump has done some things that have, you know, benefited and made things a little easier, but the reality of it, the constitutional reality of it, is that the, you know, there should be no say from the president of what he can and cannot do with waters inside a state. They don't belong to him. And even the Army Corps of Engineers, they have no business being there. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation, they have no business to be administrating or controlling our waters. And if you look at a history, you know, a lot of the dams in the Western United States, and I don't know about East, but a lot of the dams were actually built under the administration of the U.S. Department of Reclamation. Well, but mm-hmm. when you look at what happened, they would go in, and the local communities, this is before the federal government was completely advantageous, excuse me, to the people. They would go into the local people needed to build a dam. They wanted to build a dam. They were looking to contract a dam, and the U.S. Department of or the U.S. Reclamation, they were good at building dams. So they would go in and actually contract with the local people, and they would build the dams. But who paid for it? The local people paid for it. There was usually a grant, a federal grant or something, but it was, payments were set up, and those local people paid for those dams, right? This was in the 30s, mostly. Mm-hmm. And and then what happened is, after the dams were built, the U.S. Department of Reclamation would say, well, let us manage them. We're good at managing dams. And so the people would contract for them to manage the dams. Right? That's all it was. Most of these dams were paid for by the local people, and it was only a contract that allowed the federal government to manage it. Right? Right or wrong, I don't know if the federal government could get into those positions constitutionally. I'm not wanting to get into that. I'm pointing out that the rights of the dams and the waters was never the Department of Reclamation's. It was always the people in the states. But now, because they have administered these dams for so long, we're talking 60, 70, 80, you know, 90 years, now they're taking claim of them. They're right. Actually saying that the land around it belongs to the Department of Reclamation, you know, and they're taking claim of the dams. That's what those in Northern California, the issues with those dams, mm-hmm. where they want to take, that's what all that was about. And the people had to basically say, look, this dam is not yours. And as soon as they did that, the U.S. Department backed off. And that's what they'll do. They'll back off for a little so that they, you know, so that they're not completely rooted out of there. And but the people have to understand, the federal government has no jurisdiction over waters.
Right.
The Constitution gives them no authority, no power to have any jurisdiction over waters. And it's a great example of what's happened to these other rights that these federal agencies have taken over through many, many years of incremental, you know, control and deception, to where now the people generally think the federal government owns 51% of the West and owns all the waterways and the water rights. It's absolutely, it's absolutely incredible.
Dead wrong. Yeah, dead it's wrong. Dead wrong. And I will also tell you, of course, you know Elaine Willman, but they've done the same thing in Montana. Now they're going through the reservation lands to try to figure out a way to get the state to turn the water over to the federal government. And they've done that with the Salish Kootenai Water Compact, which, is totally unconstitutional. It's totally against states' rights, and they're trying to lay claim in the state of Montana. At least they voted to approve this thing, and what it does is it turns the state mandated, not voluntarily, state mandated responsibility to control the water within the state. They've actually gotten the state to acquiesce and turn that management responsibility over to the federal government on behalf of the Indian tribes.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, it's interesting that you have, you know, reservation, you know, area that's under the Department of Indian Affairs, and they're asking for the water from the state in those areas, right? Shows that there is a clear jurisdiction, a clear jurisdiction. And really what's happened is they have taken the Constitution many, many years ago, crumpled it up and threw in the garbage. And they did this, from the best I can see, they did this really right after the World War II. Now, I know that there was violations before that. I know that there was many things that happened right after the Civil War. But there was a huge power grab by the federal government after the Civil War, but then after World War II as well. And now, and you think of the atmosphere. Well, look, we just went and fought over in Europe and won and free, you know, helped those people. We were the toughest people in the world, the most successful, powerful people in the world, the federal government. And our people, that's how they thought. That's, you know, my dad's explained, basically the way my grandpa came home from the war and all of them, there was just that the United States government was the greatest thing in the world. And in maybe some cases it was.
Can I interject something here, Ammon? I want you to think about. In 1946, the UN came into existence, and all of these things started happening at the very same time that we officially created a world body that could take world government, and it all came into being at the same time. And I think a lot of people say FDR was very, very power thirsty. His second cousin, Teddy Roosevelt, our first progressive socialist president, who claimed to be a Republican but was not, that power grab started early in the 20th century. But by the time the UN came into being in 1946, a lot of these things were in place, and that's when this big power grab that you're talking about came into play. Okay,
yeah.
Now, back to you.
No, that's really good, because I appreciate your clarifying that, because I didn't know when the UN came into place, 1946, and that year is a very special year to me, and I'll tell you why, because it was the year my dad was born. But also, it's interesting enough, is 1946 is when the Bureau of Land Management was established. Mm-hmm. So the BLM, so it does line up exactly with what you're saying. It's also when things like the Bitten Agreement. I can't remember the name of it exactly. Where basically they agreed Bretton Woods. That's it. Where they agreed to start using the U.S. dollar as the world currency. It was all that period of time, and we know what that led to. We know it led to basically the printing of the dollar, overprinting, where much more than what we had in our the Federal Reserve for gold reserves. And it led to basically countries like France wanting to call in their notes. And and the government, the U.S. government, central bankers, they didn't have enough money to satisfy those notes, the dollar bill. And so they began to start establish things like FLIPMA, where they took these unappropriated lands out in the West, as they said were unappropriated, that were already states. They began to lay claim on them and use them as collateral to get the country further in debt. And that's just the reality. That's not hypothetical. So, it all ties together. And you saying that the UN was established in 1946, to me, is just like, wow, because that year is the same year that the Bureau of Land Management was established.
Mm-hmm. And incidentally, you mentioned us going off the gold standard in 71, which happened under Nixon. He was also the biggest promoter of all these federal land policies, and he created the Environmental Protection Agency. Was part of the initiation of Endangered Species Act and a whole bunch of other things. And there's one intelligent statement that came out of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and I absolutely detest that man, although I detest his cousin worse. But there was one intelligent thing that came out of FDR that we can refer back to many times. And that is, and this is pretty close to a direct quote, nothing in government ever happens by accident. Anything that happens is because it was planned that way.
Yeah. Well, it absolutely was planned. And in order to accomplish what they wanted to accomplish, they had to drive the rightful owners off the land. And so therefore they could claim it without any issues. But they had this stubborn man in Southern Nevada that wouldn't obey their lawful order and leave the land. He recognized, he did his research. He wasn't alone, but he did his research, and then he ended up standing alone because of it. Because there were others that understood this, but just didn't have the fortitude to stand. And my dad felt that it is his moral duty to God and to his country to stand on the rights that his forefathers have passed down to him. And so he stood. And I remember as a young man, teenager, there was an individual that spent some time in Washington, D.C., came down, and he wanted to meet my father. And he was associated, or he was an attorney, or associated with attorneys, Washington, D.C. attorneys, and that group. And he, talking about, this was in the 90s, okay? This was the midnight, late, or early and mid 90s. And he explained that my dad and was a great concern to them, and it was talked about often in those circles in Washington, D.C. clear back then. And I remember hearing that from this individual. I could see that he was credible. I could understand that he seemed to really know what he was talking about. He certainly had spent his time there. But what didn't add up to me is, why in the world would they care about Cliven Bundy? But now I look back and see it very clearly. He was this disruptor of this great plan that they had, and they had almost accomplished it. And my father basically ended up saying, because after going through the federal courts, after just seeing what a farce it was and what a joke it was in recognizing his rights. I mean, they didn't even know the history of the rights. They didn't even know their own acts and their own, efforts to the federal government's efforts to dispose of the land. I mean, it was literally just a disgrace that these federal courts were spewing, and the U.S. attorneys and the judges. It was completely political, and my father recognized that after trying to fight in the federal courts, and so he just decided that he wasn't going to go there. He knew his rights. He knew they weren't going to be upheld in those courts. He he saw where over and over again, independent environmental studies would show these things, and the prosecutors would just totally deny them. And I'll give you one example of one of the reasons why my father just basically took himself out of these federal courts. So they were saying that the desert tortoise was a danger to cattle, or the cattle were dangerous to desert tortoise, excuse me. And so the ranchers at the time that were still there and still trying to unite and defend their rights basically challenged that. And so the Bureau of Land Management did this study, and it was absolutely ridiculous, the study. And it was just crafted to show that the cattle were dangerous. In fact, they had a shell of a turtle, and it was smashed, and they said a cow did this. Well, so what the ranchers did, they put a rock right in the middle of a, I think it was about a 15-foot gate, and they, of a big corral. They put 100 cattle in there, and they drove those cattle out as fast as they could out that 15-foot gate. Not one cow stepped on the rock. Mm-hmm. So the idea that a cow would go and try to step on a turtle, or even that a cow did step on a turtle, is absolutely ridiculous. Now, they hired an independent environmental group to do a study, and they found out what I explained earlier, that where the cattle were, there was desert tortoise. Historically, where the sheep and the cattle were, there was more desert tortoise. And now, and that the decline of desert tortoise followed the decline of the cattle on the land. The more, the less cattle that were put on the land, the less turtles there were. In conjunction with all the benefits of the water and everything that we've talked about. So they present this to a magistrate, federal magistrate judge, right? And look at it all. It's so conclusive and so, you know, I guess profoundly evidential that the cattle and the ranchers are benefiting the land and benefiting the desert tortoise, that the judge had to rule for the ranchers. And it was a big win. Everybody thought, oh, great win. You know, this is the key. We get to keep our ranches. We're all happy, right? They celebrate, you know, that night. Well, the U.S. attorneys come out on the federal steps and in front of the media. They said, well, Clive and Bundy and the ranchers have won today. But what will tomorrow look like? That's what they said. Okay. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Something to paraphrasing, right? So then what happens? Next thing you know, the ranchers are getting noticed that they're being pulled into federal court over this issue again. And mm-hmm. so they get into this federal court, and the prosecutors get up and says, Your Honor, U.S. Congress under FLTMA, which is a Federal Land Management Policy Act, established in 1976. It was the platform for that was laid by Nixon, but he was impeached. And Gerald Ford passed it. And in that act, it says that any study that is used to determine any, you know, judicial matter has to come from a federal agency. And so, even though this study, this independent study, is more conclusive, accurate, Judge, you can only use the Bureau of Land Management study and report. And the judge says, well, according to the Bureau of Land Management study, cattle are destructive to desert tortoise, even though we know the truth, but we have to, as a judge, because of congressional law, I have to use only this study. Therefore, ranchers lose. Mm-hmm. And just like it predicted that they would continue to push it with the resources of the federal government, they can continue to push this issue until they won. Well, with that and many others, my dad just, you know, he just wiped his hands clean. He goes, if you can't get any type of justice better than that, and these kangaroo courts, I won't play in that game. You know, I won't play there anymore. Mm-hmm. And so he stopped. He stopped responding to their letters. He stopped going to the courts. He stopped everything. And he just went to ranching. He says, I have these rights. You know, he did declare those rights to him. He made sure that any contract he had was fulfilled. And then he wouldn't sign any more contracts. He began paying the equal amount of grazing fees that, you know, which he didn't have to do this, but he began paying that to the county rather than to the federal government. And he went to ranching. And because of that, I mean, this ignoring that, he just called their bluff. And now if you're not, you know, if you're not going to play in their game, in their ball, in their court, then they can't win, right? Because you're not going to play. It's like the, you know, what is it? The Globetrotters, I think that's what they're called. The that uh, basketball team that goes around. Well,
the
Harlem Globetrotters. Yeah. Well, they never lose a game. They don't lose. And why? Mm-hmm. Because the game is rigged. It's fun. It's entertaining. Mm-hmm. It's really great to watch. I mean, they do all kinds of tricks. It's amazing, you know? But they always win. And that's basically mm-hmm. what our federal courts have become. Over 100,000 cases in the West where the landowners went against the federal government, every single one of them was ruled towards the federal government. How is that possible? So yeah. My dad went to ranch. Yeah. And that is what their concern was. Look, Clive and Bundy won't play the game anymore. You know, how are we going to take his rights if he won't play the game? If he won't get in here and play the game, and you know, how are our judges and our lawyers going to win this thing if he won't play the game? And so that became
And therefore they send their militarized BLM forces out, and literally the kangaroo press that we have, the bought and paid for lamestream media. And turn Clive and Bundy into public enemy number one because he stood up for his rights.
Yeah, and that didn't happen at all. When he stopped playing in the courts, I think it was in 1993. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about, you know, 2014. So 20 years later. And mm-hmm. so you might ask, you know, your listeners might ask, well, why didn't they come earlier? Well, I'll tell you why, because they knew they were wrong. And they did. They absolutely knew they were wrong. They knew my father was right, and that was terrifying to them. They knew he wasn't going to play their game anymore, and that he was going to expose them if he had the chance. And my dad stayed very public. But the reality is this. They didn't come after him back then because they didn't have the political power, right? They did not have the political power. And also, the federal land agencies didn't have a large enough army to do it. See, they were still relying on the local law enforcement to enforce their laws, which a lot of the local law, sheriffs and so forth wouldn't enforce their laws, so it made them very weak. So we see literally mm-hmm. a 20-year period where they're trying to build up their political power enough that they can justify this attack on my father and family. And also, they're building up this army. And I'm talking about a true army. There was 213 mm-hmm. men in 2014 that came and converged upon my father's ranch. They had four helicopters. They had, in those helicopters, high-tech equipment. They had MRAMs, a full military base. You know, they had parabolical listening devices, drones. I mean, I could go on and on. I don't have this in front of me, but I could go on and on with the things they had. It was a military operation. In fact, the prosecutor in our trial actually said that it was a military-type operation. Steve Myrie said that. Mm-hmm. And they came, but 20 years ago, that would be unheard of. And in fact,
go ahead. I'm sorry. I just want to interject something because everything does. It all connects. That's why we call this program Connecting the Dots. It all connects. In 1992, UN Agenda 21 came into existence under the program they had at Brazil on the environment, okay? George Herbert Walker Bush signs on to that program on behalf of the United States of America. Clinton takes it before the Senate, the Senate for ratification, and it was voted down 99-1 against ratification of the program on sustainability. Then Bill Clinton in 94 creates the President's Council on environmental policy and starts implementing all these programs through the various federal agencies that promote UN Agenda 21. In 2001, George W. Bush, through the so-called 9/11 incident, implements the Patriot Act, which literally strips about 90% of our constitutionally protected rights under the guise of homeland security and protecting the homeland. And then in 2009, President Barack Obama, under his administration, starts recreating the government and implements a program where he even states openly, we need a federal police force every bit as big and as powerful as the United States military. Okay, all these things connect. Now, I want to turn it back to you because I want you to talk about all these things. But our listeners need to understand all this stuff has been so planned so far in advance. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and I'm going to pull up here. I want to... You know, their plot at the coming into the Bundy Ranch and is basically they wanted to provoke my family or my father first, my family, and then also the local community. They wanted to provoke them us into acting in violence. That was their plan. So then they could justify, you know, basically the force that they were going to use upon us.
And it was proven in court that they intended to kill a lot of your family members. That was proven in court, wasn't it?
Well, to the point where they actually said that if we resisted in any way, this would be another Waco or Ruby Ridge. That was an agent from the Bureau of Land Management. So,
right.
But for nearly two decades, they had tried to, they had painted my father and laid a deceitful plan basically to try to provoke my father into violence. And they painted him, you know, as a radical extremist. And then they tried to set up these situations where that were to provoke him into violence. And my father always has stayed peaceful. And even when he had every right to use violence, he never has. And, you know, I could go into great detail of this, but I do want, let me read just a little bit of something that was written.
Amen.
Yes.
If you'd like, if that's something that you can, what you would like to put up on screen, if you put the link over in the YouTube chat there, I can pull it up and put it on screen for our viewers.
No, unfortunately, I apologize. I probably should, but I don't have it in a link. I'm reading it off of a document.
Okay.
And so I would love to do that. But I want to read this to you. And the reason I'm reading it to you rather than just telling you about it is because I want you to listen to the quotes. And the quotes are right out of the certified discovery in our case. Okay. So you tell me what the plan was. Now, I've taken and connected the dots with my own writings, but you tell me if me connecting the dots is accurate or if I'm inaccurate off of the quotes and the evidence in here. So for over 20 years, each time federal agents would provoke my father by threatening his life or property, he would call on the state and county officials to protect and resolve. Because federal agents could not provoke my father into reacting in violence, justifying his removal from the land, preparations to destroy the Bundy Ranch in 2014 were made by officials of the BLM, FBI, and U.S. Attorney's Office. In sensitive government documents, officials admit that up to that point, quote, Bundy himself is less prone to initiate and support violence, unquote. They further admit that they did not know, quote, Bundy's threshold or precise trigger that would elicit a violent response, unquote. Oh, excuse me, not unquote. So they did not, but they did not know Bundy's threshold or precise trigger that would elicit a violent response. Nor are we able to detect what his actions would be to a direct threat, unquote. However, quote, if pressed into a corner and faced with having to defend his property, family, or persons, his actions may be hard to forecast, unquote. In official planning documents of this imminent action against the Bundy family, a plan was laid out to visefully use excessive federal force to push, quote, Bundy beyond his threshold, unquote. Oh, sorry, I did it again. And either summons enough fear in Bundy to lose all, quote, semblance of hope, unquote, or give up his claim on land, leaving him with no choice but to defend his family and property. The official plan states, quote, it is important that Bundy realize that impound operations are imminent so he can develop a plan B, unquote. Further, it states that this will give, quote, Bundy time to really weigh his options, identify and organize key players, and decide how he wants to handle the response of violence, unquote. Federal officers further reveal in this plan that, quote, while this planning time presents a double-edged sword for our LOE operations, it is in our best interest to face off against a more stable and measured Bundy contingent, vice a caged and reactive one, unquote. It is evidence that the official federal plan was to exhibit such a show of force upon my father, family, and the local community that it would either put them in a state of terror, causing them to lose hope or react in opposition, giving federal agents justification to arrest, dispose of anyone who would oppose them. Now, I could go on and give examples of this. I could go on and give specific examples, but it gets pretty long. But I do want to get in here, and I want to read one more part listing the force that they used against my family. Let me get past this. Even after their plan didn't work, they created a new plan during the operation to try to entrap my father. I could get into that sometime, but probably not on this show. Okay. Mm-hmm. The militarization of the Bureau of Land Management. On March 27th, the Bureau of Land Management contractors began setting up what they called the Incident Command Post, the ICP. Many people, including national reporters, said, quote, it looks like a military-type base, unquote. The discovery reveals that, in fact, it was a military-style base and that the operation was a military-type operation. On page 7 of the operation plan, it reads, quote, the operation will be under the Incident Command System, ISC. This system is based directly off a military model, unquote. In explanation of the actions of the BLM agent, U.S. Attorney Steve Myrie said in open court that, quote, they were a military force of some level, unquote. The ICP was equipped and with command facilities, communications towers, light towers, sniper posts, MRAPs, barricades, gate guards, tents, helicopters with special equipment, and canine units, just to mention a few. The April 7th incident report, the ICIC, shows that the operation was up to 213 personnel, 143 personnel with tactical gear and training, 51 support staff, and 19 contractors. Many of the federal agents were outfitted with armed vests, helmets, and tactical fatigue, fully and semi-automated AR-type style rifles, short-barreled, not legal for the public, grenade launchers, range finders, ammunition belts. During the operation, specific training was taking place, combat recovery training, CRT, canine attack training, specifically for Bundy protesters, equine familiarization training, EFT, how to subdue a man on a horse, eminent force tactical training, EFTT, and some of the militarized equipment identified in the discovery are 4 helicopters in total. At least one was equipped with FLIR, F-L-I-R, and other specialized equipment. Mm-hmm. At least one was equipped with a gunman on board, mine-resistant armored vehicles, MRAMs, portable communication vehicles, parabolical listening devices, high elevation helo target support, not where they drop. What is that called? Where they drop from anyway? But it's called mm-hmm. it was called helo. Observation planes or drones with infrared and night vision technology. As far as it can be determined by the discovery, the target support equipment remained disarmed, but it had the option it shows a disarmed and armed, and you could see that it was still on the disarmed section, but they basically were crosshairs. While the crosshairs were trained on protesters in Bundy home. One national talk show host explained the excessive show of force by the BLM agents as, quote, government gone wild. Now, I mean, I could go on and on, but you see the level of force that they were willing to use against my father and their plot that they clearly laid out in their own documents to try to provoke him to violence. And, you know, I'm pleased to say that my dad never, ever allowed himself to be provoked. And he had many opportunities in 20 years. He had every reason to say, you know, you dirty, rotten, I won't even say it, you know, what they did to him. Mm-hmm. And in fact, listen to this. I didn't read this part, but I wanted to read in one of their reports. It says, to their frustration, my father would not be provoked to act in violence. Federal agents reported that Bundy was too savvy to allow himself to be provoked. I mean, these are the documents that we finally got. If you remember, they were withholding these documents in our case. That's actually what got our case dismissed with prejudice. All of these most of these documents, they were withholding because they knew that it revealed the true plan of what they were trying to do to an American citizen. An American rancher, a cowboy.
Hey, Dan.
Yeah.
We're about 7 minutes from the top of the hour here, so we're going to have to wrap it up here soon.
Okay. Well, first of all, Ammon, I want to thank you because this is exactly what America needs to hear. They've heard the wrong side of the story so many times. And they've heard things that are just absolutely not true about your dad and about the whole standoff issue. I'm going to try to have you back sometime very, very soon. I want to talk about Malheur. I want to talk about Lavoie Finnegan, how that all came down, how they literally ambushed and murdered him. The fact that he was, one of the people who was going to take his property rights back. The fact that he stood up against them and that the reason he was at Malheur was for the same reason. You were trying to make a stand for the Hammonds who had been tried and found basically not guilty by a judge. Because all they had done was try to do a backburn to protect their own property, which is a fairly normal thing. And in fact, they had ended up being attacked and then sent back to prison by a second judge who had come up with a completely different sentence. In other words, double jeopardy on a court. And so we've got a lot of things going on here. Ammon, I'm sorry that we could talk for probably 10 hours on this. We will be talking for hours on this at our Red Pill Expo coming up in 2 weeks. It will be November 7th, 8th, and 9th. I'm very much looking forward to meeting your dad at that event. I have nothing but the highest respect and regard for him, and I look forward to the opportunity to talk to him. I have a small cattle ranch on my own here. I also grew up in the ranching and farming mode, and my My background, I'm a commercial building contractor, and I know your dad was a heavy equipment operator and commercial, did a lot of that. So I look forward to the opportunity to meet with your family, and I want you to have a chance to say quickly anything you want to say as far as sites or places where people can learn more about you, and then we'll turn it over.
Well, I'll give a shout out to the Red Pill Expo. Again, it's going to be in Mesquite, Nevada, November 8th and 9th. And I would like to say that anybody that would like to, you know, I'd have to probably do it. Oh, I don't know when I would do it, but I'll try to find some time. I have to get the schedule for the, I don't want to compete against them, but that would like to go up and see some of these waters on the mountains. It'll be beautiful this time of year. And basically I'll come to Mesquite, Nevada, and we'll go up on the mountain. We'll see, I'll show you some of these waters. Some of these water heads have been there for, you know, over 100 years. And if you remember when I was tased, during the whole 2014, when they came after me, they tased me multiple times. Because I parked my four-wheeler in front of a dump truck. Well, in the back of that dump truck was, they were destroying these waters, concrete pipes. So they wanted to destroy these waters because it was like killing two birds with one stone. So I'll take you up there if you want, but come to the Red Expo. That's, or the Red Pill Expo. Mesquite, Nevada.
Okay, well.
7th and 8th and 9th.
Yeah, and we're going to have, we can't have Jeanette Finnegan at the event because she's going to be in court in Colorado, but she is sending her daughters, and they're going to be there representing the Lavoie Finnegan family, and they're going to be selling books and doing things there. So, this is going to be a big deal. This is a big event, and we really want our listeners to come. Please get online, redpillexpo.org, and get your tickets for this event because you're going to have an opportunity to meet Am and Bundy in person and very likely some other of the Bundy family members. So, Am, thank you again. And with that, Thumper, we'll turn the program over. I know that we've just scratched the surface on this, Am, and I can't wait to have you back for another interview later.
Well, thanks for having me on. I sure appreciate your efforts. Absolutely.
Yeah, Sam, and thank you.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for joining us on Patriot Soapbox. I hope you come back to Patriot Soapbox very soon. Very, very thank informative. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Absolutely.
You bet. A pleasure. Well, Dan, we made it through it.
Yeah, this isn't exactly an ideal situation with my phone and everything, but we're learning here, and I just thank our listeners for their patience. But I'll tell you what an informative interview. I mean, Ammon is a very, very, the Bundy family are just nice people, just good old-fashioned farm and ranching families, and they come from a background, they're very polite, very good people. And if you think these people are the enemies of the United States, you are dead wrong. They're what America was made of.
Well, he brought up some really great points about the water rights and all of those things that go way, 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 way back. And they're trying to just stomp all over that stuff. And that was one of the things that just couldn't be tolerated anymore. So it's a good thing that they did what they did. It was tough times for everybody.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've reached the top of the hour there. And I see Pam.
Well,
and,
Patrick, you take over. We'll come back next week. And Hammond, we'll have you back to talk about Malheur. Look forward to that. Patrick, good program coming up. Patrick Howley, thank you. And God bless.
God bless everyone.
And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths and to secret proceedings. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence.
It was 1776 when the founders signed the writ of independence from the Brits. It was revolution. Now an enemy from within would enslave us all again and deprive us of our rights in the Constitution. Restore the Republic. Wake up, it's time to understand. Restore the Republic. We're losing our freedom in the land.